All right. Thank you for coming. So this is the second lecture of a series. Last time I described to you how we went about developing some biologically based local circuit model for working memory, namely how do you really just think about a microcircuit that has certain degree of realism in terms of biology that allows you to go across levels from behavior to recurrent circuit dynamics and all the way down to receptors to explain something like stimulus-selective precision activity in working memory representation. So one of the things I talked about is this idea that reverberation through recurrent dynamics should be slow and dependent on NMDA receptors. You know, in addition to biological implications, that you know, finding led us to view this kind of models in a slightly different way. Instead of thinking about those kind of systems in terms of switches, in some sense you can think about persistent activity that outlasts the transient input as a form of time integral of a transient input in the sense of calculus. So today what I'm going to talk to you about is how do you use exactly the same local circuit originally designed for working memory to look at decision-making computations. So let's start with a very well-known by now and rather simple, elegant perceptual decision-making task called the two-alternative forced choice task. So in this experiment, you are shown a display of dots in which some dots move coherently together in one direction, say upward A, downward B. All right. The important thing is that you can, from trial to trial, parametrically change how hard or how easy the task is by changing the fraction of dots that go together, which is called coherence or motion strength. So in this example, half of the dots move together, the other half move randomly in any possible directions. So the question is, when the coherence or motion strength is very low, like 5% or 0% sometimes, monkey doesn't really know the difference, just try to make one of the two choices. What's going on in the brain? How neurons and how neural circuits in a subject perform this kind of hard decision? In order to address that, you know, experimentalists like Mike Shatterland, Bill Newsom, carried out single unit recording while the monkey is performing one of the two versions of the tasks. So remember, you know, you have to keep in mind monkey's behavior as well as the neuron you're recording from, right? So in this example, you first find out, which part of the screen the recording neuron likes, called the receptive response field of the neuron, and then you put one of the two possible choices inside of the response field of the cell and the other one opposite from it. Then you show the dots, and the monkey look at the dots and decide whether it's A or B, by a saccadic eye movement to the target to the left or to the right. That way you can read out how long does it take for the animal to make a choice, so you can read, you know not only the response but also the reaction time. The problem, a little bit of possible confound in interpreting neuron data you're going to see, is that when you see a neuron signal that seems to be related to decision, may, as a matter of fact, be related to the motor response, the saccade, right? And so in order to separate temporally the choice from the actual motor response, there's a second version of the task, so the fixation duration, where you're supposed to make a choice during stimulus presentation and then remember that choice across a delay period. So in a way, this is a combination of decision and working memory. So at the end of the delay, again, you produce a saccade indicating your choice. All right, so that way you can separate choice from motor response in time. So as you would expect, when you decrease the motion strength, the task becomes more and more difficult, so the performance goes down in a psychometrical function shown here, whereas the reaction time goes up. It's like when you make a harder and harder decision, two things happen, right? Usually it takes longer time for you to decide, and secondly, probably it's more likely for you to make a mistake. Still, with trained animals, the performance can be rather high, above 80%, 90% correct, even when the motion strength is only about 10%. So when the monkey performed this task, they recorded from single neurons in areas that are important for this decision computation. So for example, the visual stimulus arrives in the cerebral cortex in B1, which projects to this specialized area called IMT, which is dedicated to processing motion visual stimuli. All right, so you can view V1 or IMT as sensory areas, which in turn projects to part of the posterior parietal cortex called LIP or prefrontal cortex by virtue of MST. Both posterior parietal cortex and prefrontal cortex project to many other areas, including a subcortical structure called spiral corpus, which is important for so-called motor command for saccadic eye movements. So you can think about this as a motor structure. Those are the sensory areas, and somewhere in between, the decision is made. For those of you who have not seen this slide, I'll walk you through. This is a well-known, interesting finding from the Shadrin lab in the reaction time task, right? So what you see here are the averaged single unit data from LIP in three different motion strength conditions in different colors. You see those three curves corresponding to the trials when the monkey's choice is towards the response field of the recorded cell, right, in solid curves like this, whereas the other three curves correspond to the trials when the monkey's choice is opposite from the response field of the cell, right? What do you see? Well, you see several remarkable things. For one thing, you see this ramping activity. That's not a steady state, right? And the ramping slope is slower with lower motion strength, right? So there's this idea of transient ramping activity that perhaps corresponds to your daily life intuition that when you try to make a hard decision, you need time to weigh the evidence, accumulate the information in favor of each of the options to consider, right? And that's shown in the form of ramping activity in single neurons. Secondly, even with motion strength zero, there's no correct choice. And yet you see that the activity is different depending on monkey's decision, right? A would correspond to this one, B would correspond to the other one. That means that the neural signal now you see is no longer reflecting the actual stimulus, but the animal's subjective choice. And thirdly, those same time courses, neural activity, are replotted over here on the right by aligning them at the time of, saccadic response rather than at the time of stimulus onset. Now you see is that when the saccade is produced, the activity seems to reach the same level, right? That's very appealing and exciting for people, both in neuroscience and psychology, because this seems to remind people of a very simple mathematical model in psychology called the drift diffusion model or ramping to the threshold model. The idea is that you have this perfect integrator that integrates external input biased by the evidence in favor of A versus B. And if you add up information over time to some point, to a threshold, then you say, oh, I know enough, then I decide it's A. So that way you can read out the choice. If the threshold is positive, that you reached, and you can read out the reaction time as well. If you go instead the other way to a negative threshold, then the choice will be B. Right, so there's a very simple, perfect integrated model for explaining some kind of innate decision variable dynamics that may underline decision making. So we thought that the slow reverberation that we end up with, kind of surprisingly, when we design a working memory model, might explain this kind of ramping activity. Let me show you a version of the model that is applied to this task. So here, think about the two populations of neurons selected for A versus B. And again, within each neuron pool, you have a bunch of spiking neurons that talk to each other through recurrent excitation that depend on NMDA receptors. And the two neuron pools compete against each other through inhibition, right? So this is a simple version of the working memory model that I talked to you about last time. Now, to simulate decision making, you have to design the inputs carefully. So the way we did it is to assume that inputs reflect the outputs from sensory coding neurons in NT. Right? So for example, if you have a stimulus in favor of A with 100% coherence, then the input to A in red is very big, and input to B is zero. Right? On the other hand, if the motion strength is zero, actually the input to A and B is exactly the same. The system is symmetrical. You have identical input to the two neuron populations. And yet you will see that through this strong stochastic dynamics, the system will generate a categorical choice. One of the two neuron pools will win the competition. Right? And then you can interpolate and you can simulate a model with any motion strength or coherence. So the model captures salient observations from neurophysiology in a monkey experiment. So this is a simulation of fixed duration task. You see that neurons show this ramping activity that's faster with higher motion strength, like seen in the real neurons. And secondly, of course, the actual time course of neural activity is very different depending on the either neuron pool group A wins the competition or neuron group B wins the competition even when the motion strength is zero. And thirdly, if you have to remember your choice through a delay period, that is a binary thing. It really is independent of the motion strength you start out with, right? You try to make a decision based on the motion strength, but at the end of the day, once you have made a choice, you try to remember that choice in a binary way in a delay period that's independent of the motion strength. And that you get for free in this model because the model was originally designed for working memory, right? Here are two individual trials, again, same thing, but with zero motion strength. You see that in trial one, motion the neuron population A in red wins the competition, whereas in trial two, neuron group B in blue wins the competition. Now, instead of showing the neuron population A or B as a function of time, you can plot the same thing in the state space, where you plot firing rate A along one axis and the firing rate B along another axis, right? So in that case, the state of the system corresponds to one point, and the time course corresponds to a trajectory, right? So you see that in trial one, you'll start out here, and initially you run around along the diagonal line that corresponds to this part of the dynamics when the two firing rates are similar, and then eventually it deviates from the diagonal line, and you end up being over here in an attractor state where firing rate A is high, firing rate B is low, right? In the second trial, in orange, you do the opposite. So you wander around and then you go to the other way. Here, you know, it's fun. Actually, it's important before I show the next slide to just to emphasize that this network has an interesting duality. Although it's an attractor network, right? That gives you this categorical choice. It can also show this very slow transient here on a time scale of more than 1 second that allows the system to integrate information over time. Of course, the attractor dynamics is also the mechanism explaining persistent activity in working memory. Now, it's fun to look at individual trials like this, just to drive home the point that for, from the point of view of neural dynamics, decision is made by sampling. It's not by knowing a probability distribution and through a dice and decide whether the choice should be A or B. Instead, it's by a stochastic temporal dynamics, right? This is indicated here across individual trials. Actually, interestingly, from a few trials like this one or this one, during the stimulus presentation, the activity remains along the diagonal line. You can say that the system sometimes actually procrastinates. So it does not know what is the right choice in those examples. This kind of trajectory plot is also becoming more and more important in experimental neuroscience because these days you can record for many neurons at the same time. So in principle, imagine this is an example actually from David Tang's lab where they recorded from several hundreds of single units in a decision task. And then you can look at the trajectory, right? Again, the state of the system is represented as a point in a state space in high dimension of population activity, and then you can analyze this kind of trajectory in decision making. In particular, they use this approach to look at exactly at what time points in error trials the trajectory deviates from the trajectory in the correct trials, right? That way you kind of really go into the system and figure out when and how and why the system made a mistake in single trials in principle. You can do that in single trials if you have population recording from many individual neurons. So the model, you know, captures the behavior. Here's a psychometric function from the model compared with monkey, both for the fixed duration task and for the reaction time task. Now, you know, having established this baseline, we can ask, what do we learn? What kind of thing we can look at in the model and come up with something that we can talk to experimentalists as predictions? So one thing you can ask is, how do you show that time integration is really important for decision making? Well, one way to test that time integration is really doing something for you, useful, is to change the duration of the stimulus, right? The idea is that if time integration really helps you to make a decision, then the longer is the stimulus duration, the more you can integrate the signal, so the better you should perform, right? And that's easily done in the model, as shown here. So this is model simulations showing performance with four different time durations of the stimulus. And indeed, you see that with a longer and longer duration of the stimulus, the performance gets better and better. Right? You can quantify that by asking, for example, what's the motion strength or coherence you need to achieve a fixed high performance, like 90%, right? So that you know, required coherence level would go down with longer stimulus duration if integration benefits your decision. But you also see that this benefit plateaus eventually, right? And so the model predicts that you benefit, but then eventually you plateau, so you cannot really you know, keep benefiting from longer and longer stimulus presentation forever. Why does that happen? You can say, well, maybe the system has a leak, so you always reach a steady state, unlike the drift diffusion model, which does not have a steady state, right? So if you reach a steady state, then you know, you stop integrating, you stop growing up, and that's why you have this plateau. That turns out to be the perhaps wrong answer, but I'll show you in the next couple of slides. But this, of course, can be done in experiments, and here, Chiani and Shadlin did exactly that manipulation in the monkey experiment and found exactly the same thing, right? Okay, so I was just saying that maybe this is simply because you know, drift diffusion model is an idealization, but in the real brain you have leak, so the time constant of integration in a given microcircuit is not infinite, right? So it's you know, limited, and that might explain the plateau. So let's try to test that even further experimentally. So one way we thought about testing this is to introduce a brief pulse of motion energy during stimulus presentation, which can be in the same direction as the stimulus itself in green, or it can be in the opposite direction from the actual stimulus in red, right? So the idea is that if you have a real integrator, you should be able to integrate this pulse, right? And take that into consideration in your decision. Now the question is, if the explanation for this plateauing is a leak, reaching a steady state, that means your system is forgetful, right? Leaking out information. Now the question is, if I show the perturbation early in time or very late in time, right before you make a choice, which one would give you a bigger impact on choice if it's a leak underlying the plateauing? Any guess? You would say late, right? Because you'd say, you know, if I show the pulse too early, and the system is forgetful, then you know, by the time you make a choice, that signal is no longer there. Right? On the other hand, if you get that pulse right before you make a choice, that should impact you. Right? So the prediction from the leak explanation would be that the impact would be the biggest if your pulse perturbation happens very late in time. How about the slow reverberation model? Does it predict the same thing or something different? Well, look at the this state space trajectory again, right? So if you are late, that means you are either here or here, right, near the attractor state. Now, if you have a little perturbation, does it matter? Does that help you to make, you know, a choice? Not really, right? You're already committed to one of the two possibilities, so a small perturbation should not bring you, you know, to the other side, so to speak. Yeah? On the other hand, if you present the same pulse at the very beginning, that means that your internal state is around here. Right? You're near the diagonal line, then a small perturbation would bias you this way or that way, so that should have a bigger impact. So this prediction of the reverberation mechanism would be that, in fact, it's the opposite. Right? So the early perturbation should have a bigger impact. And this is indeed what the model found, both for neural modulation by the pulse and the behavior influenced by this perturbation. And that's what's found in the monkey experiment as well. I just showed the neuron data, but also at the behavior level is the same thing. That is in contrast, for example, to the perfect integrator hypothesis, for which, because the time constant is infinite, the timing doesn't really matter, right? So that's somewhat different from the prediction from here. Now, let's talk about decision threshold, right? So the idea is that you accumulate information up to some point, then you're done, you read out what's your choice. What's this idea of decision threshold biologically? Well, when neurons are accumulating information like this, the activity keeps going up, then the excitation from those neurons downstream also builds up in time, right? So perhaps we should look at downstream to really understand what the meaning of a decision threshold. So in fact, for this shadowing experiment, one candidate downstream system is this spherical oculus I talked to you about, where neurons are usually rather silent. At least the subpopulation of neurons in the spherical oculus are like this. They are quiet, and then it generates this huge burst of brief response right at the time of saccade generation. Right? There's a command signal about a saccade that has information about where to generate saccade, how big is the saccade. Right? So imagine that those neurons get excitation from decision neurons in the cortex, which builds up in time. So maybe there's a nonlinear thresholding kind of phenomena that would explain really what is the decision threshold. So to examine that possibility, we extended the model from the cortex to include a spherical oculus as well as part of the basal ganglia, which is known to play a role in controlling voluntary oculomotor behavior. So here's a simulation from this extended model. You see that in a single trial, the neurons in the cortex ramp up, which generates ramping activity in the input layer of the basal ganglia, which in turn inhibits output layer of basal ganglia, right? And so a combination of cortical excitation from here to the spherical oculus and reduced inhibition from basal ganglia eventually triggers a very powerful all-known event. So then you can ask, what is the threshold of activity that triggers this burst event, right? So we have examined that in this model. You see here that the time it takes to reach a particular level triggering the burst in the spherical oculus varies from trial to trial. You get a distribution of reaction time. Those are two different conditions with different motion strengths. But regardless of the reaction time, the time it takes to trigger the motor response here, the threshold defined here actually is constant. So the threshold defined this way, just by reading out in downstream system, is rather stable across trials. and the slope of ramping is inversely related to the decision time. One thing that's quite surprising to me from this model that I don't show here is that now you can ask, when you have to deal with speed accuracy trade-off, right? Sometimes you want to go really fast. Maybe you want to lower the threshold so you can hit the threshold much faster. Or sometimes you take time to be as precise as possible. That, you know, in that situation, you may want to raise the threshold so you can integrate inflation for a longer time to be more accurate. How you can adjust the threshold, right? It's a question that can be examined in this model. To our surprise, the threshold for decision making cannot be easily modulated by changing the strength of cortical spherocollicus projection. So if you make the projection stronger from cortex to spherocollicus, it doesn't really change much the decision threshold. Instead, it's the cortical striatal projection that can be sensitively modulated to change the decision threshold, which is, I think, is interesting because we know that the cortical striatal connections are very plastic and modulated by dopamine, and that may be a side for this speed accuracy trade-off. Now, using this mechanism, you can read out the reaction time. So here's the mean reaction time as function of the motion strength or coherence in the model. Actually, I never know which one is which. So here's the model, here's the monkey data, which is similar as the monkey data. And one thing you notice is that not only the mean reaction time increases with task difficulty, but also the standard deviation increases with the task difficulty in a linear way, right? And that's not really put in by hand in the model. So you'd say, oh, that's interesting. That's a form of Weber's law in psychology, namely the variability of reaction time is proportional to the mean. And we look at the behavior data from monkey experiment. We found the same thing, right? And then you say, OK, let's look at the whole distribution of reaction times, see if you have something like that. So this is what's shown here are five different distributions of reaction time in the model with five different motion strengths. Right? When the motion strength is high in blue, you have this rather narrow distribution on the left. With a lower motion strength, the curve shifts to the right, meaning the reaction times are longer, but also the distribution is wider, right? As you'd see here. But if you replot those five curves against the relative reaction time divided by the mean, all five curves collapse into a single functional form. So that's a very strong form of scale invariance of reaction time histograms. Do monkeys show that? Well, if we look at the monkey data, indeed, we replotted the published data and found the scale invariance of reaction time statistics. That's frankly rather surprising. Remember that the model was designed for working memory, right? We had no idea that it would provide this kind of predictions applied to decision making. And then supposedly you know everything in the model. So using the model, we could start to understand the circuit mechanism, wiring, the excitation inhibition balance, etc., that gives rise to this scale invariance at the behavior level. So decision making usually is characterized by three things, right? Your choice, the reaction time, and the confidence. How confident are you about your choice? Let me just spend a few minutes talking about the confidence. This has been studied in many labs using human and non-human animal subjects, including here. Let me just show you one data slide and the related model. So one key thing to look for neuron signals that might reflect your sense of confidence is summarized here. This is a recording from single units in a part of the thalamus, subcortical structure called povena, in a perceptual decision-making task. Let me skip some details. Basically, along the x-axis, the task is easy on the left and the right, and hard in the middle, right? And you see that the performance is high over here and here for the monkey, and low over here. And also the rate of making mistakes is the opposite, right? So you tend to make more mistakes in the middle, as shown here. This is the single neuron data from Povonar, showing that, you know, basically when the evidence is strong on the left or right, and you make a correct decision in black, your confidence should be high, right? And that's the activity also is high at a single cell level. On the other hand, when the evidence is strong on the left and the right, you made a mistake. You probably should not be so evident, confident. And so the confidence estimation should be low over here and over here. That's what they found at the behavior level using this opt-out option, you know, behaviorally. But also single neurons show the same kind of dependence, all right? And this is a very typical type of neural signal you look for if you want to find where in the brain can actually compute this kind of confidence estimate. So we just published a paper suggesting a mechanism for this computation. That was inspired by some other, actually, in vitro physiological experiments about the circuitry from the thalamus, sorry, from the cortex to the thalamus, including Povonar. So here, think about neurons selective in the cortex, selective for the two options converging onto a neuron in the Povonar. There's a thin layer of neurons between the thalamus and the cortex called reticular nucleus, which are inhibitory. So the finding from in vitro physiology is that the cortical thalamic projections show facilitation, whereas the projection from the reticular nucleus to Povonar neurons show short-term depression, right? So what that means through this short-term plasticity mechanism is that if your activity is high for winner, you would facilitate and strengthen this projection. So the positive signal would be enhanced by this short-term facilitation, whereas the negative signal would be suppressed, okay, through the short-term depression, right? And so if this is a winner, this is a loser, you would get, you know, A minus B, if you like, right? Because this neural population would show lower firing rate, for which short-term facilitation would not be very significant, whereas short-term depression also is not so important. So you tend to see basically the net inhibitory input onto this neuron. So you get a positive signal here, negative signal here, in the case that, you know, the winner is on the left rather than on the right. If you flip, you can compute now y minus x. So really, this is the mechanism that allows you to compute the absolute value of the time of the difference between two numbers, right? That's exactly what you need for this kind of computation, you know, reproducing the signature neuron signal about confidence estimation. So from there, right, I talked to you about those three things, choice, reaction time, and confidence. Let's see if we can use same kind of thinking and the computational modeling to look at a bit more complicated decision tasks. One of the important tasks that people use a lot is called Wisconsin cut sorting task. That involves rule, that involves task switching. So in this example, you are given a deck of cards. On each card is shown a number of shapes in different colors. Right? So you have one red square, two green stars, etc. Now, there are three behavior rules, shape, color, and number. You have to figure out what's the correct rule to follow in order to sort out cards. Right? So in this example, you are here, you are shown four cards. If the rule is color, what is the correct card to pick to be on this pile? Well, it's this one, right? Because that color is the same as this color. On the other hand, if the rule is the number, that's not the correct answer. This is the correct answer, right? If it's the shape, then this is the correct answer. So subjects that have frontal damage have a lot of difficulty switching between you know, different rules. And this is a very interesting rule-based task switching paradigm that people use very widely. So there's also a simplified version of this task applied to monkey. In this case, you are shown a color, so there are only two dimensions, color and shape. You are shown first a stimulus, like a blue square, and then you show three other stimuli, right? And depending on the rule, color or shape, you are supposed to match the relevant feature. For example, if the rule is shape, this is the correct answer over here. If the rule is color, this is the correct answer, right? And the people recorded from single neurons, again, in the prefrontal cortex, and found very complicated signals, very heterogeneous, very hard to explain what really is going on in this kind of task. So we tried to kind of start with the decision circuit I explained to you and apply it to this paradigm, and we failed for a long time. We realized that in the end, we need something something new, something to be added to our model. Namely, to solve this kind of problems, we need to deal with context-dependent information, right? So it depends on the behavior rule, which is a context, you have to do different things, right? Sometimes you do this incorrectly according to rule one, but it's no longer correct according to rule two. So you need neurons that are sensitive, not just to one thing, but to a combination of things. Stimuli or motor response, but also context. And a very simple way to, in the model, generate this what we call mixed selectivity signals is to introduce a reservoir of neurons for which connections are just random. Right? So we call them randomly collected neurons. Because the connections are random, individual units are naturally sensitive to a combination of things. And then we found that by adding this randomly connected neurons, our model now can solve the Wisconsin card sorting task. The model also explains very heterogeneous and temporally complicated signals as seen in the monkey physiology. So this is just one example. Maybe in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the details, just give you the impression how the model units in our mathematical model show this very complicated time courses and also heterogeneity across units, which is quantified here, actually on the right, where we just show for each epoch in a single child, stimulus, delay, for each of the 70 units, for a given unit, whether that neuron is doing anything, selective for stimulus or for context or for motor response, et cetera, right? And that we actually made this plot, because the experimenters made the same plot for single units from prefrontal cortex in behaving monkey. And you see that, to some degree, the model explains this high degree of heterogeneity and the temporal dynamics as seen in the monkey experiment. We further, in the follow-up paper in collaboration with Ora Miller, analyzed the single units from Ora Miller's experiment and found evidence for mixed selectivity. That conceptually could be really quite useful because signals in the prefrontal cortex for a long time have been really hard to interpret and explain. And so the idea of mixed selectivity, maybe in combination with plasticity, provide a way to look at rather puzzling kind of physiological observations. So far, I talked to you about models without plasticity. So let me spend a few minutes now talking about what happens if now you incorporate synaptic plasticity in this kind of model. In particular, when we make a choice, we always make a choice based on what you expect to get out of it, right, as output. So of course, depending on the output, which is a big reward, small reward, punishment, you will do something different next time, right? So the idea is that when you make a choice, depending on the outcome, there's a signal like dopamine-related reward signal that will somehow change your circuitry in the brain a little bit, and you can generate choices adaptively. So let's see how we can simply incorporate that reinforcement learning in our model. The psychometric function I showed you several times now is really just this, namely, in a single trial, what's the chance that you choose A, population A wins the competition, as function of the difference in the inputs to A versus B, right? That's all that it is. But it really looks like something that's commonly used in psychology, sometimes called sigmoid or softmax decision criteria, right? Now, let's assume that I'm going to incorporate reward-dependent plasticity for those two numbers. Those are the strengths of inputs, GA and GB, right? So for example, if you choose A, you get a reward, dopamine somehow it modulates plasticity, so GA is enhanced by long-term plasticity. What that means is that wherever you are, you're going to move to the right a little bit, right? So in that case, next time, you're more likely to choose A again. On the other hand, say you choose A, you don't get a reward. Then you would get depression through this plasticity mechanism. You would move to the left. So next time, you're less likely to choose A. Right. So we apply this idea to a number of situations. Actually, a rather simple plasticity rule I'm going to show you next slide can explain using this model a number of types of decision makings, tasks such as foraging, competitive game, or even probabilistic inference. I'm going to spend more time a bit talking about this as an example. And categorical learning I'm going to mention as well. So start with this softmax decision criterion. Sorry, I changed the notation from GA to CA, from GB to CB. The learning rule is very simple. So if in a single trial, population A wins the competition, you don't do anything to the synapses to B, okay? So CB does not change. And if you choose A, you get a reward. The learning rule says that you just increase CA by some amount, right, like this, with the learning rate Q. Whereas if you choose A, you don't get a reward. You get depression, so CA is reduced by some amount with learning rate Q again, right? Now, let me show you that just this single learning rule applied to the decision second model can even explain Bayesian type computation. So this is again the same team by Mike Shadrin. Here they train the monkeys to perform what's called a weather prediction task. So that's borrowed from human studies where you are shown a number of cues and then you try to predict whether it's going to rain or not today. Right? Each of the cues you are shown is related to some kind of log likelihood odds that is going to rain, okay, or not. And you're supposed to combine the cues to make a Bayesian inference about whether it's going to rain or not. So in this experiment, they have 10 different visual shapes. Each one is associated with a log likelihood odds that, one of the two options, say red, red meaning green here. No rain means red, and you're going to decide whether it's rain if you make a decision to green, or not rain if you make a decision to red. So each shape is associated with a log likelihood odds about these two possibilities, and each time you're shown four randomly sampled from the 10 possible shapes. You are supposed to combine the evidence by adding the log likelihood odds, right, to make a decision. Monkeys seem to do that. So this is the performance of two monkeys showing that the probability of choosing red, for example, is the a sigmoid function of the sum of evidence from the four different shapes in favor of red. Ali Sotani, but then as a graduate student, thought that we could actually explain what they see using an extended model of decision making. So this is our two choice decision circuit. Now we have another layer that computes the action values for A or B, which in turn gets input from sensory visual neurons that are selected for each of the 10 shapes, right? So each time on a single trial, you randomly choose four of those shapes that project to A or B value selection neurons that in turn drive the decision neurons, all right? And I just told you that you know, over here, in the end, if you decide A or B, it's going to be a sigmoid function or softmax of the difference in the total inputs to A versus B. And now the total input is the total input by summating the inputs representing the four different shapes, right, for A versus B, right? So this is just the generalization of the formula I showed you, nothing new. But you can rewrite this formula, right? You do log, and then you'll find that, of course, this is the same thing by saying that the log odds of choice probability now is just the sum of input differences. Nothing I've done so far. That's new. But now, using the learning rule I just explained to you, and this is a step I'm going to skip, but it's very easy to show, that in fact, through trial to trial, right, CA sometimes goes up, CA sometimes goes down, CB sometimes goes up, CB sometimes goes down. Using that learning rule I just explained to you, you can show that actually each of the C values in the end through trials is going to reflect the posterior of A given a given shape or B given a given shape, right? And this math actually is very easy, given the formula I gave you about the learning rule. So then you can replace C and CB by the difference of the posteriors, right? And one final step that Ali realized, it's a very simple mathematical approximation. So in this case, this is x, this is 1 minus x, so this is 2x minus 1, and you will find that actually 2x minus 1 is very close to log of the ratio of x over 1 minus x. It's just mathematical approximation. If that's the case, now you can replace p minus p by the log ratio, right? Voila. And now you get what exactly was observed in the monkey experiment, namely the probability of choosing one of the two options is a sigmoid function of the sum of log posterior odds. I think there are two general points to make here. One is that at least under some condition, you do learning through a number of trials. Actually, plasticity would be a way to reflect the frequencies of events, naturally, right? Which would be, in turn, probabilities. So the probability quantities might be learned this way, right? Rather than in some other forms. We can compute, maybe there are alternative ways to represent the probabilities, but this certainly is one way through learning. Secondly, because the neural activity is driven by synapses, and the synapses in turn reflect probabilities, now if you record from neurons or you measure, you know, both signal, you know, MEG, then you would see neuron signals that will be correlated with probabilities, right? Even though the actual computation is done at the synapse level, right? And this is explicitly shown here. So in our model, because of what I just told you, that the neural activity in the model is modulated by the summated log likelihood odds, as shown in the monkey experiment. Before I move on, let me make another point, which I thought is quite interesting. So the learning rate is something that everybody cares about, and in the context of meta learning, in the context of volatility. So let me make a point where the kind of learning rule I explained to you is very similar to this one, although not exactly the same, which is familiar to perhaps everybody here. This is a very simple reinforcement learning model where you try to compute an expected value function v for a given sequence of reward events, right? And you do that by updating your estimated value v by adding a prediction error signal delta, which is the actual reward minus expected reward, with a proportion, that's the learning rate, how fast you learn the expected value. So for example, if the actual reward is bigger than the expectation, this is positive, you go up, whereas if R is smaller than V, you go down, right? That's very simple. But another way to think about alpha is that it's really inverse of time constant. This is a leaky integration of reward events with a time constant given by 1 over alpha. One way to see that is that imagine that you don't get the reward for a long time. So R is 0, you just update your V negatively, right? So R is 0, you just have minus V here. Well, you can see very easily that then V will decay exponentially with a time constant tau given by 1 over alpha, right? So there's this idea, right, that if the environment you are facing is stable, like in a stock market, everything is stochastic, but the statistics is stable, then you're supposed to use a long tau, a low learning rate to learn about the statistics of the environment. On the other hand, if your environment is very volatile, since changing, even the statistics change all the time, now it doesn't buy you to integrate information, so you should use a much bigger learning rate and short tau to figure out what's going on. Indeed, Bayesian theory combined with human study by Tim Berens some years ago showed that the estimated learning rate is lower in a stable environment in the lab and higher in an environment when it becomes more volatile. So we wondered if we can actually physiologically find this learning rate or time constant, even at a single cell level. So the idea is to look for, this is in collaboration with Dale Lee, who did a single neuron recording in this competitive game task from three different prefrontal areas and one from posterior parietal cortex. So the idea is that you just look at the modulation of neural activity in a given child, depending on whether the animal gets a reward in the previous trial or not, right? Or the animal gets a reward 2 trials before, or 3 trials before, and 4 or 5 times, 5 trials before, etc. That way, you plot neural modulation, right? The modulation of neural activity in the current trial, depending on what happened in the previous trials, and then you get this, time course of memory about the reward events. Right, you see this, decaying exponential function. So from there, you can extract the time constant, which is, again, the time constant that this neuron reflects the history of reward events. Yes? Just like, 1 over alpha, if you like. Okay? But for a single neuron. And it turns out that the extracted time constant is changing from neuron to neuron in the recorded neuron population. If you put all of them together from many hundreds of recording neurons, you get this kind of histogram. Look at the top first. The bottom is a mathematical model explaining the observation. I'm not going to have time to explain this, but you see that this actually is a log-log plot, that the histogram, the distribution of reaction, of not the reaction time, of the time constants for reinforcement, right, span several orders of magnitude. Actually, the decay of this distribution is a power law, with a power 2. Right? As some of you know, power law is really interesting. That means that you have a lot of long time constants that you would not expect with a Gaussian distribution or exponential distribution. Right? So what this potentially implies is that, in fact, given a neuron population, you have at your disposal a reservoir of time constants for reinforcement learning, right? So there are short time constants, there are long time constants. So if the environment changes, right, from stable to volatile, you probably, one possibility actually just to pick the right neurons with the right time constant for reinforcement learning. In other words, reinforcement learning really should be generalized to high dimensional space with all these different time constants, right, in different subspace. That's a kind of radical idea, but I think it's a very attractive one, worth pursuing. So another interesting type of decision that, you know, in my mind, perhaps will be an important step towards understanding more abstract concept formation, is to look at the categories. I'm illustrating this by 6 or 8 examples of chairs. Right? So sometimes you are asked to classify visual objects into categories, which are not obvious, like in these examples, right? And maybe not really based on similarity of features across objects. In this case, I don't know what's the shared, you know, feature, right, across all 8 different examples. You know, some chairs don't have legs, right? The colors are all over the places, shapes are all different. If we can learn about how the brain learn categories of this kind, perhaps we'll start to have some insights about how concepts are produced and, you know, go to more complicated cognitive functions. My collaborator, Dave Friedman, has looked at this for a long time. This is a very simple paradigm using, again, random dot motion stimulus. So our old friend, we know how to deal with this, so to speak, right? So in this paradigm, again, using single neuron physiology of behaving monkeys, you first show a stimulus in certain direction, which is an analog quantity, right, from 0 to 360 degrees. But you train the animal to classify this feature into one of the two classes arbitrarily. You know, so you know, along the ring, you just cut the ring and say, on this side in blue is category A, on the other side is category B, right? So the animal, to perform this task, has to classify the stimulus and remember that across a delay period. At the end of the delay, you show a test stimulus in another direction. And the task is, for the monkey, is to decide whether the test stimulus belongs to the same category membership, has the same category membership, belongs to the same category as the sample. So you can't really do that just based on feature similarity, right? So for example, if your sample is here, your test is here, the similarity is very low for the two, but they belong to the same category. On the other hand, if sample is here and test is here, actually they're very similar in feature, but they belong to different categories. And they found that single neurons, after, you know, training, in the prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex, show category selectivity. So you see here that regardless of the actual directions in category A versus category B, the activity of this recorded neuron seemed to show this binary response. And it also shows, remembers the category across a delay period, right, when input is no longer there. We developed a model to try to understand how category learning happens. I'm going to skip a lot of details, but just to maybe show one slide, you know, reiterating this idea of trajectories, but also maybe bridging with the last part of the talk. So instead of asking how you can learn a category, you know, simple, let's say, can I build a model for the whole task, right? Categorization for the sample, delay, and then, you know, categorization of the test and comparison between the two categories, right? Making a decision, match versus no match. And that's a bit hard to design by hand, right? So we decided instead to use this training recurrent network approach. Here's the kind of the most interesting, I guess, result from our model and then compared with the analysis of single units in LIP from the monkey experiment. So the long and short of it is that we now can think about what I described to you as a sequence of decisions that would correspond to a trajectory in the state space of neuron population dynamics. So in this model, right, you would start here, and given a sample stimulus, you classify it into A versus B, that would bring the trajectory either to the left or to the right, right? So here's the start of the delay. So this is the stimulus presentation. And here's the delay period. During the delay period, you know, the system may stay here or wander around a little bit in the state space. And then at the end of the delay, you show a test stimulus. Now, depending on the test matches or doesn't match with the sample, you see that the trajectory bifurcates again into two possibilities. If it's a match, you go this way. If it's no match, you go the other way. Interestingly, the match versus no match state, you know, is shared, right? Depending on whether you go this way or the other way. So if you go the other way, your trajectory goes this way, and then during the test stimulus, again, there's a bifurcation of the trajectory. But you know, if it's match, you go towards the same match state. And if it's no match, you go to another state that corresponds to no match. And that's essentially what we found in the population neuron dynamics. So you know, there's this during the test period, there's this bifurcation of trajectories. If it's match AA or AB, you go this way. If it's no match BA or AB, you go the other way. This model by a graduate student, Jia, was developed using this training recurrent network paradigm, which I did not explain to you what it is. So let me spend the rest. Oh, we're almost done. How much time do I have? Maybe 5 minutes? Very quick. Sorry for going over time. Just to tell you a little bit about how we use this approach to look at something that's about multitasking. So the inspiration is that prefrontal cortex is good for not just one thing, but many different things. I explained to you, working memory, inhibitory control that I described last time, perceptual decision making, and context-dependent decision making, in which you show, again, a display of random dots, but dots are in color. So depending on the rule, direction rule, you just do the usual classic task. If it's a color rule, now you should ignore the motion signal and decide whether you see more green dots or more red dots. Okay, so there are two different tasks that depend on the context again. That depends on the prefrontal cortex. You know, categorization I told you about, even social decision making. There's a very interesting paper recently published showing that neurons in the prefrontal cortex also signal whether you know you should cooperate with your partner in the game or not. So can we design a model that can do many, many different tasks that will start to explain representation of tasks rather than stimulus or even decision? So I really don't know how much time I should spend on this. It's a very interesting story, I think, and just came out. How about this? Let me just plan to explain the story in within 10 minutes. If you need to go, feel free to leave. Okay, I'm not offended, but I think it's not good to rush just for 2 minutes. Let's spend 10 minutes to go through this story. So the idea here is that you have a recurrent network that gets different kind of inputs. For our purpose, there are two types of sensory inputs, direction and color. Right? So that will allow me to simulate the context-dependent decision task, for example. Right? There's a fixation input. When it is on, you're not supposed to generate any response except the fixation response as output. Okay. But when it's off, now you have to produce a say saccade response to one of the directions. That's the output that you're going to read out from the network. And then there are some rule units. Here, I noticed that this is an old slide. There are 18. Actually, in a published paper, we have 20. Right. So in a given trial, only one of the 20 rule units is active. That instructs the network which of the 20 tasks you're supposed to perform. Right. So if unit one here is high, the other ones are not there, then you should perform behavior one, etc. All right. And the network doesn't do anything at the beginning. The connections between units are random. And again, there's no functionality whatsoever. But through this training protocol, a form of backpropagation called stochastic gradient descent, actually the network gradually learns to perform tasks. The question is, can a single network perform many different tasks? We chose 20 tasks that are commonly used in monkey physiology. Those are the ones that include working memory, perceptual decision making, context dependent decision making, multi-sensory integration, auditory versus visual information integration, pro versus anti-saccade, that would involve inhibitory control of prepotent response, delayed match the sample, delayed match the category, et cetera. It turns out that indeed you can train a single network to do all these tasks as shown here. So the performance goes up through training for all tasks, and the error function, if you like, or the cost function goes down when the performance goes up. So after training, now the network can do any of these 20 tasks. You are in a good position to ask novel questions, such as, if now I open the box, look at the recurrent units and the wiring diagram, can I learn something about representation of tasks, task sets, right? Rather than about sensory stimulus or behavioral choice. So one way to do that is for each unit, for a given task, you look at the time courses for different stimuli, and then you ask, what's the variance of these time courses? That gives you a number, right? So if that unit is engaged in that particular task, the task variance should be high, whereas if it doesn't do anything for that particular task, it's not engaged, so the variance would be low or zero, right? So you get a number for each task, for each unit. So for a single unit, you would get 20 numbers, right, for 20 different tasks. And then you get a matrix for different units and for different tasks. With this matrix, we can start to analyze whether the representation of task sets is organized in certain ways. So for example, using the so-called TSNE analysis, you could look for clusters. And indeed, we found that neurons in the recurrent network seem to display a number of segregated clusters. So some, for example, are important when any task involves delay, right? And they will not be active if there's no delay. Some other, some units. And some other units, like in red, are really engaged only for anti-saccade, when you need to suppress the, a particular prepotent response, et cetera, et cetera. So, but on the other hand, a same unit can be engaged in multiple tasks, right? So we start to see some kind of generalization of task sets. Let me skip a few slides in the interest of time. Just show you one more thing before I stop, which has to do with compositionality, which is, of course, very, very essential for human cognition. Language is naturally compositional, right? So we thought that maybe some of the tasks that our network learned to do have some compositionality. So for example, delayed go, maybe delay plus go, right? Delayed untie, maybe delay plus untie, et cetera, right? So we analyzed task set representation using in a state space again. Each point here corresponds to a task in high-dimensional space of recurrent population activity. And we found, indeed, there's some kind of compositionality. For example, if you go, if you start with a task representation for go to delayed go, it's parallel with the task representation from untie to delayed untie. Right? Okay? We've tested this finally using a combination of rule inputs. So instead of showing your simulation, activating the rule that tells you delay on time. That show a combination of three rule units, right? So one would be on time, the other one would be delay goal, and the third one would be negative goal, right? So on time plus delay goal minus goal would be delay on time, right? Indeed, we found that, you know, of course, if you show this rule, you perform really well for delayed on time task. But if you only show one other rule unit, on time, you perform very badly with the delayed on time task. If you show two signals, it still performs badly. But if you show the combination of three rule units, now your performance is as good as the initial one. Just providing an example of compositionality in this model. Now let me end with this crazy slide showing that, illustrating how I explained to you a little bit how we go step by step looking at different cognitive functions, but mostly looking at the microcircuits, right? So starting next week, we're going to discuss how we can now go beyond the local circuits and start to look at multi-brain regions that work together in a large-scale system. Thank you very much.